we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show, Western Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 Co-op Radio, CFRO, in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, November the 20th, 2015. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I am joined here in the studio today by our co-hosts, Alyssa Ray.
Hello.
And Elise Jacobson.
Hi.
Jackie is away today. Welcome, everyone, and welcome to our special guest, Carmen, who's listening in today. We have a packed show for you today. For our first interview, we will have local activist Sarah Wall on the show. She is the head of the brand new Vancouver chapter of an animal activist community based in New York called Collectively Free. They're now in Vancouver and have already been quite active in the past month with direct action. Collectively Free works towards total animal liberation through anti-speciesist messaging, highly creative nonviolent actions, and pro-intersectional empowering community building. Sarah will be here today to tell us about the organization and the Vancouver chapter and how you can get involved. Then for our feature interview, we will have vegan chef extraordinaire Tal Ronan on the show. You may best know him from being Oprah's chef during her 21-day vegan challenge, or perhaps from his super popular restaurant in LA called Crossroads. The fact is that he is one of the leaders in the world of vegan food activism, and he's done so much in recent years to pave a path for this movement that could really just solve so many problems in the world if people embraced eating plant foods only instead of animal-based foods. I'd say he's a pioneer in taking the steps towards normalizing and mainstreaming veganism via getting the message out and getting the food out in so many proactive ways. He'll be on the show today to tell us about his latest food activism endeavors and perhaps to show you a whole new way of thinking what varieties of food you choose to make and eat. That interview is coming up in about 29 minutes, so please do stay tuned. Now, Alyssa, you had the opportunity to see a show of a vegan musician who was in town last week. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, I did. I had been looking forward to the show for a very long time. Well, about a year, actually. So it's this artist named Lila Rose. She's actually Toronto born and raised, Canadian musician, but she's based in California now. I'd heard her music before, just really interested in her style. It's dark, kind of electronic, acoustic, just the mood and message of her music before. And then I learned that she was in the midst of producing an album fully dedicated to animals and to the suffering of the planet, just to what's going on in the world. And I learned that she is a vegan and an animal activist. And I saw her Kickstarter page where she actually had a lot of footage from Farm Sanctuary in California, and she was talking about her connection with the animals and how she's always wanted to merge her activism and her art, for the cause and just to get the message out, to reach people's hearts in a way. And my soul kind of sung when I heard that, because that's something I've always wanted to do. I used to be a musician, and then activism took over. And I'd love, one day I imagine it coming together. And I just love that she put it together. So she created this 11-song album. And it's called We Animals. It's a concept album about the interconnectedness of all life, including our Earth. It's a call to action. It's a plea. It's a lullaby. It's a love story between Lila's heart and all creatures everywhere, including you. The title track called We Animals, we'll listen to at the end of the show. The line in that is, "We're animals, lest we forget it." And it's just trying to, remind people that we're all in this together. There is no separation. Like, let's remember that connection. And the song I want to play a little bit of right now is called Nothing to Lose. It is a call to action. She says, nothing to lose, only some to save. All these voices pounding up inside of me. Years found tears, unsure of just quite how. I was screaming to help out. I just wanted to play hard, but held back by doubt. Just shout it. Courage takes courage, I know. Own it, own it. What are you waiting for? So you can check out Lila Rose's music at lilarosemusic.com. All the songs are on her Bandcamp page. You can stream them there. I highly suggest, though, supporting, you know, local artists. I bought her CD at the show, and she has amazing, like, T-shirts. I got a shirt with a cage with, like, bars peeling open. Really powerful stuff. I want to just share her words about her album. She says, I want people to see the interconnectedness of all life. I want the music to allow people to feel the expansiveness of their emotions and to feel passionate and angry and inspired to make change in our lives for the greater scope of things. Color me inspired. Her show is so powerful. She's just really a performer. Great theatrics. She was singing in a cage a lot of the time, wearing a tiger costume with a tail and ears and everything. Yeah. And it just that image, and that fearlessness to just speak up and speak from her heart. It was so powerful. Yeah.
Well, thanks for that, Alyssa. I mean, Lila Rose, check her out. I think her website's lilarosemusic.com. And hopefully we'll be playing some more of her music on the show in future weeks to come.
Yeah, and I want to have, I almost got an interview with her, but it didn't quite work out. But I'm going to do a full, like, feature interview. I can't wait to talk to her.
So cool. Well, yeah, I'm sold. I think the next time she comes to town, I'm going to go see her. So I am one of the moderators of the Vancouver Vegans group, which I think all of us here are members of. It's a very active group on Facebook for local vegans. And we had a question in the group recently that we thought we would discuss on the show. It was about vitamin B12. A member asked, how do you all get your vitamin B12? Do you supplement or eat fortified foods? And this is a big question in the vegan community. It's an issue that comes up a lot. So I thought maybe we could start by kind of sharing, like, you know, where we do get our B12. I personally take a supplement about twice a week. I think a 2,500 microgram supplement, and I periodically eat fortified foods, things like non-dairy milk and occasional veggie meats and that sort of thing. Those all have B12 in them.
And maybe just for our listeners who don't know, like, why is this question even happening for people who don't know? What's the issue with B12 in vegans?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's vitamin B12 is the one nutrient that is pretty much not available in plant foods. It is it occurs in meat, in animal products, because it's present in the bacteria in animals' intestines. So basically, in order for vegans to meet our B12 needs, we do need to get B12 from other sources. A lot of foods are fortified with B12, so it's very easy. It's just something that you have to pay a little bit of attention to. The RDA, I think, for B12 is 2.4 micrograms. A microgram is a thousandth of a milligram, so it's a very small amount, but it is essential for preventing nerve damage.
And so some people might also ask, too, is like, okay, then a vegan diet isn't sufficient then if you can't get all your nutrients from it. And from what I know, and the answer I have to that is that years ago, our food was dirty. We used to pull carrots out of the ground and eat them, right? Mm. And pull potatoes out of the ground and eat them. And yeah. And so we got our B12 from the nutrients that were in the soil. Mm-hmm. So I know that's an issue now because everything's so sanitized.
Right.
But strangely enough, to answer the question as to where I get my B12 from, I do have sublingual, and that is you put them under your tongue, supplements that I use. They're easy to find in the store. And apparently the B12 is best absorbed that way if you mm-hmm. put it under your tongue. Just for people to know, but I don't really take them. I usually forget, and then I hardly ever take them, and especially this last year I haven't, because I got a blood test last October, and apparently it was shown that my B12 was too high. Hmm. And then I got it redone just a couple months ago in July, and same thing. So I asked my doctor, I'm like, I'm vegan, I don't take supplements, I don't understand, why is my B12 too high? And he said, his first answer was, oh, it's in everything. So I think by that he meant prepared foods, mm-hmm. packaged foods. I think I don't eat too much of that, but you know, in your cereal and your soy milk, it's fortified. Mm-hmm. And then he also said to me that, and then he said some people absorb it better than others.
That is true. Yeah. And our bodies do store it for years. So often, you know, for folks who haven't been vegan for very long, for example, you will still have stores of it built up from, you know, when you're eating foods higher in B12. However, you know, obviously stores do deplete over time. And so it is important to make sure that you have a source of that nutrient. Fortified nutritional yeast is something that a lot of vegans use. And yeah, again, non-dairy milks, veggie meats, all of that. B12 supplements, thankfully, are very cheap and very easy to find. You can get, you know, decent ones at any drugstore, and they're very inexpensive. So, but I did want to talk a little bit about that, though, because I hear a lot of vegans saying that this is something that I've, you know, done a lot of research on, is that, I got a B12, a blood test, and my B12 levels were very high. And there's an article about this actually on veganhealth.org, which I cannot recommend highly enough. It's an awesome website, a great resource for nutrition information. And it's about how blood tests are actually not a reliable measure of B12 status, because there are various foods that can falsely inflate your B12 level on those tests. For example, sea vegetables, seaweeds, spirulina powder, chlorella powder, that sort of thing, which a lot of vegans eat. Even things like, I think, certain mushrooms and tempeh and stuff, they contain inactive B12 analogs. So these are things that will show up on blood tests as B12, but they are not actually B12 that can be absorbed by your body. So I think that sometimes vegans can get a little bit too comfortable, like, oh, my blood test results were really good, and so I don't have to worry about this, I don't have to supplement. And but it is something that we should pay attention to. So basically the resources I would recommend the most are veganhealth.org, and also the veganrd.com has a great vegan nutrition primer on on vitamin B12, and it's extremely helpful and informative.
Well, thanks so much for that, Elise.
Hey there, Co-op Radio listeners. Do you like food? Of course you do. Would you like to learn more about food? Why not? Well, then tune in every Monday at 8 p.m. for Food Line Radio, where we talk all about food. Sourcing food, buying food, the politics of food. Hey, even cooking food. Food, glorious food. Listen every Monday at 8 p.m. for Food Line Radio on Vancouver's Co-op Radio 100.5 FM.
You are listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
Now for upcoming events. Saturday, November 21st, that's tomorrow, 2 to 4 p.m., there's the big changes at the Greater Vancouver Zoo protest. Their byline is "Fall is here," and there are some big changes at the Greater Vancouver Zoo. Most notably, the zoo now has a new owner. It's important for us to take this opportunity and make it clear to the new folks in charge of GV Zoo that our position against their cruel captive business remains firm. The animals need you at this important protest. Again, that's tomorrow, Saturday, November 21st, 2 to 4 p.m. Meet at 264th Street and 56th Avenue in Langley.
Hey, and Direct Action Everywhere has a very important event coming up. You can in Vancouver. So if you want to learn more about their events, you can go to Direct Action Everywhere Vancouver Coast Salish Territories on Facebook. So what it is Saturday, November 28th is actually about their 2-year anniversary here in Vancouver, and they have something really big planned. Now, they're a little bit mysterious about what exactly it is, but if you've, you know, if you've seen any of Direct Action Everywhere's, you know, actions in the past, you can kind of get a sense of what they do. It's kind of theatrical, and usually involves chanting and holding signs and such, and disrupting the everyday norming of violence against animals. So if you want to speak up, even if you never have before, they're just the most lovely and welcoming crew around. So Saturday, November 28th from 2 until 4, so 2 hours you could do with your Saturday afternoon, something really important, and you know, just check it out. So they're meeting actually at an organizer's house, but they're super friendly and open, and they're asking people to join them for their biggest day of action yet. They're going to meet at the house and then head to their location together, and specific action details are not being posted publicly at this time, but if you want more information, or, you know, if you want to just leaflet or take photos or just watch the event, you know, they're open to every kind of level of engagement. So again, check out Direct Action Everywhere, Vancouver Coast Salish Territories, and their event called A Deadly Feast, Saturday, November 28th.
Also on Saturday, November 28th at 8 p.m., the third screening of the documentary Vancouver Aquarium Uncovered with the final edits will take place at Eternal Abundance. Seating is limited and by donations. Please book your tickets now. Again, that's Saturday, November 28th. The documentary starts at 8 p.m. at Eternal Abundance, which is at 1025 Commercial Drive in East Vancouver. The website of the documentary is vancouveraquariumuncovered.com. If you have an animal-related event that you'd like us to share on the show, please post it to our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, or email us at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com.
Thanks for that, Elise. I just wanted to mention, too, for people who are interested in learning more about the Vancouver Aquarium Uncovered, we had the filmmaker, Gary Charbonneau, on the show a couple of months ago. So I think that's available on our website, animalvoices.org, if you want to check that out. That was a really good interview. It's a really well-researched film. So please do check that out if you can.
For our first interview today, we have local animal activist Sarah Wall, also known as Sarah Fox, on the show. She is the head of the Vancouver chapter of the nonprofit animal rights group known as Collectively Free. Collectively Free is an activist community that works towards total animal liberation through anti-speciesist messaging, highly creative nonviolent actions, and pro-intersectional empowering community building. She is here today to tell us about the organization and the work that she has been involved in doing. Hello, Sarah, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Hi, thank you.
So please tell us about Collectively Free. When did this organization start? What are its goals? And how did you get involved in recently starting the Vancouver chapter?
Well, Collectively Free is an activist community that works towards total animal liberation through nonviolent messaging, incorporating intersectionality and community building. Our goal is to create a network of individuals to help create social and political change, and we also believe in erasing all forms of exploitation and oppression in our society for all humans and non-human animals. And I actually decided to start the Vancouver chapter after learning more about the organization, watching some really empowering videos, and talking with the founders of Collectively Free. And Vancouver is actually the second chapter in Canada. As the organization actually started over a year ago in New York in the United States, and it has been for over a year branching out across the United States.
So can you please talk to us about community and why that's an important part of Collectively Free?
Well, social change can only grow with a very strong community. So community building is very important to us. And right now, Collectively Free has only been in Vancouver less than a month. So we are just starting with our community building. And this will include reaching out to other people who are interested in veganism, interested in animal activism, interested in social and political change, and to also have community events and get-togethers, as well as having our actions and protests.
With regards to the intersectional mandate, why do you feel it's important to incorporate this message in all the work that you do with Collectively Free?
Well, intersectionality is extremely important to Collectively Free, to be as inclusive as possible in every action, in every material that we do put out there, to ensure that we truly are free from oppression of animals and the oppression of humans. So intersectionality is actually something we are constantly discussing and including in all that we do.
Well, I'd like to hear about some of the actions that you have done so far in Vancouver, and maybe you can tell us about how you've incorporated the human rights angle into that as well. So maybe you can start off with Starbucks, for example.
Okay. Well, with the Starbucks action that we did, we had activists that did go into Starbucks, and we talked about the exploitation of the coffee bean workers and the exploitation of animals. In the countries where the coffee bean workers are living, they're getting paid usually around a dollar a day, and they work in often very extreme weather conditions, like very extreme heat, and they often don't have any kind of bathrooms or even showers or anything like that to be clean, and there's very unsanitary living conditions. And there's also a lot of children that are working in the coffee bean fields, so we definitely feel that there is exploitation here of humans. So this is something that we are trying to let people know about, and we do have actually a petition that is on our website at collectivelyfree.org, and the petition, you can sign the petition, and we are asking for fair trade practices, because just about 93% of Starbucks is not fair trade. So we're not telling people don't go to Starbucks and telling people not to go there. We're asking people to help make change and to ask for fair trade practices for these coffee bean workers. And we also do encourage people to stop exploiting animals simply by not consuming their bodies or their eggs or their milk. Starbucks is actually, there's been a lot of protests and actions against Starbucks with Collectively Free. So this is something that's kind of ongoing with them because of their exploitation of humans and of animals.
And are there any other actions that you've done so far in Vancouver? I know you've only been around for a month, but I was looking at your Facebook page. It looks like you've been quite active so far. Anything else that you'd like to tell us about other actions that have taken place in Vancouver?
Well, our very first action that we did was actually on the SkyTrain. What we did, it was called Unmask the Truth. And what we did is we had devices that showed footage of the animal agricultural fur and leather industries on it. And we just went on the SkyTrain, and we were at the stations and on the train itself, and just were showing the public the footage and wore masks at the same time. And this was done actually for us. We did ours day before Halloween, so that's why we had the masks on, and it didn't really seem out of place because we were, with us wearing masks, other people were dressed up as well. And the first action that we did actually, it was myself and my daughter, and it was our very first one, and there were supposed to be other people, but because we were new and there was a lot of other things going on, it was just myself and my daughter. But and she actually, my daughter is 7 years old, and she's an animal liberationist as well. So she does come to protests and actions with me sometimes, and she actually really enjoys doing them. So she was with me, and she actually took the footage of me in it. She did a really good hub with her filming. So we're hoping that the more videos we have out there, the more people know that we are here, the more people will hopefully get involved in our actions and in any of our meetups that we have.
So speaking of getting involved, how can people get involved in the Vancouver chapter or other chapters of Collectively Free?
Well, people can get involved in the Vancouver chapter simply by going on Facebook and searching for Collectively Free Vancouver Area. And you can feel free to send us any message, and you can feel free to comment on any of our posts and any of our videos. If you want to get involved in another chapter, you can go to our website to see what other chapters we have. And again, you can go to our main Facebook page and just search for Collectively Free.
Well, thanks, Sarah, for coming on the show today to speak about your work with the Collectively Free Vancouver chapter. You can find out more information at collectivelyfree.org and also find a link to the Vancouver area Facebook page and the Starbucks petition on our website at animalvoices.org for the November 20th show. Thanks, Sarah, and good luck in your future work.
All right. Well, thank you for having me.
You're listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, Coast Salish Territories. And now for the news. Big news this week. 2 years after retiring most of its research chimpanzees, the U.S. National Institutes of Health is ceasing its chimp program altogether. This was reported on in the scientific journal Nature. In a November 16th email to the agency's administrators, NIH Director Francis Collins announced that the 50 NIH-owned animals that remain available for research will be sent to sanctuaries. The agency will also develop a plan for phasing out NIH support for the remaining chimps that are supported by but not owned by the NIH. The director, Francis Collins, said, "I think this is a natural next step of what has been a very thoughtful 5-year process of trying to come to terms with the benefits and risks of trying to perform research with these very special animals. We reached a point where in that 5 years, the need for research was essentially shrunk to zero," end quote. The NIH retired about 310 chimpanzees in 2013, in line with recommendations from an internal advisory panel that drew on recommendations from the then U.S. Institute of Medicine, now the U.S. National Academy of Medicine. The agency maintained a colony of 50 reserve animals that could only be used in cases where the research meets a very high bar, such as public health emergencies. Stephen Ross, an animal behavior specialist who served on the 2013 advisory panel, says that from the beginning, the NIH considered retirement of the reserve animals to be an option if researchers were not using them. He said, "It's clear that chimpanzees are not a needed resource in the biomedical research world." According to Collins, a director, the NIH has received only one application since 2013 to use chimps in research, and that application was later withdrawn. The FWS has not received any requests for research exemptions since the endangered species protection took effect earlier this year. Collins writes that the NIH's first priority will be to transfer 20 NIH-owned chimps from the Southwest National Primate Research Center in San Antonio, Texas, to Chimp Haven, a government-funded sanctuary in Keithville, Louisiana. Next will be the 139 chimps at a facility in Bastrop, Texas, which is owned by the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. Now, of course, animal rights activists are thrilled by Collins' move to retire the NIH chimp colony. Justin Goodman, director of Laboratory Investigations for PETA, said that experimenting on chimpanzees is ethically, scientifically, and legally indefensible, and we are relieved and happy that NIH is fulfilling its promise to finally end this dark legacy. He went on to say, "We will continue to encourage the same considerations be made for all primates and laboratories," end quote. The group has been pushing the NIH to end primate research. On October 20th, it delivered letters to about 100 people in Collins's home neighborhood, asking them to approach him to protest a set of experiments at the NIH that involve removing baby monkeys from their mothers to study stress in infants. So yeah, it's a big one.
Wow.
Great news.
Cool. I don't know, I can't help but think, like, yeah, there's all the other animals, you know. Like,
that's true.
It's almost like they're saying, this is indefensible,
right.
But the rest of it all
right
is
direction.
Defensible.
Yeah, good point.
I don't know. All these little kind of, like, little improvements, I'm always like,
yeah.
I mean, it's great, but, you know. Yeah, good for those 50 chimps. It definitely makes a big difference.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
Yeah. I had just a couple other little things. I wanted to share this one because I really like this powerful image. So two zebras escaped from a circus in West Philadelphia on Sunday. It led police on a wild chase for miles through the city. The zebras, according to witness accounts, somehow got loose from the Universal Circus outside the Mann Center and ran out of the front gate. And police confirmed that the zebras were loose and they're trying to catch them. And they ended up catching them, but at least they were free for I think it was even like hours.
Aww,
that they were running free.
The thing about those stories is it gets out into the media and it gets people to think about why are they in captivity in the first place.
They obviously want to get out.
People always cheer on for these animals, like the cows that escape slaughterhouses and run down the roads for their life, and the pigs that fall off the slaughterhouse trucks and run away and hide in the woods for days or weeks before getting caught. At least, again, it's, you know, baby steps maybe, and we can see the positive point there that maybe it just like plants seeds in people's minds, right?
Yeah. I always enjoy those stories of escape, and especially the stories of like fighting back when the captive animals actually hurt their trainers and captors. Those are my favorite.
Yeah. Well, that's all the time we have for the news. Thanks for that.
For our feature interview today, we have one of the world's most celebrated vegan chefs, Tal Ronan, on the show. Tal Ronan is the founder and chef of the new Crossroads Vegan Restaurant in Los Angeles and the author of the New York Times bestseller vegan cookbook, The Conscious Cook, as well as the author of the brand new cookbook of the same name of his restaurant. He is a graduate of the Natural Gourmet Institute, has conducted master vegetarian workshops for students and staff at Le Cordon Bleu campuses worldwide, is the co-creator of Kite Hill almond-based cheese, and is a collaborating chef at the Wynn and Encore hotels in Las Vegas. You may also know him from being Oprah's chef when she did her 21-day vegan challenge in 2008. He's also been known for catering Ellen DeGeneres and Portia de Rossi's vegan wedding, Arianna Huffington's party at the Democratic National Convention, and the first vegan dinner at the U.S. Senate. Hello, Tal, and welcome back to the Animal Voices show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so it's been a long time since we had you last on the show, which was 2010. I know you've been doing so much since then with all of your new vegan food endeavors. And the biggest one, I think, has been the opening of your restaurant Crossroads in Los Angeles, which I've been to twice myself now. Can you tell us about Crossroads and why you say it's Mediterranean first and vegan second?
Sure. Well, when we opened the restaurant, we wanted to bring something new to LA, and we decided to have a theme to the restaurant that made sense to us and our backgrounds. Both Scott, our executive chef, and myself, me growing up in Israel and Scotty cooking Northern Italian cuisine for 25 years, wanted to make a Mediterranean restaurant and have a menu that was more cohesive, and that's basically what we did. I think most vegan restaurants focus on vegan first, so the commonality between the food is the fact that it's vegan, but you get served, you know, nachos and miso soup and all these different dishes that don't really go together, so we wanted to do something that really flowed well.
Well, in your cookbook, you say that there's no obvious vegan cues at the food at your restaurant, and customers don't even make the connection that it's plant-based. So I'm wondering, who is going there? Who's going to Crossroads?
You know, I think most of our guests are not vegetarian or vegan. There's a ton of great vegan restaurants in L.A., but not a lot that concentrate on really great, you know, wine programs, a full bar, white tablecloths, just really good service from the moment you step into the valet when you're seated. That's basically, you know, who we are, who our guests are. It's just people who like good food.
And what do you wish to achieve in offering people a delicious dining experience of plant-based food there in West Hollywood?
Want to show people that eating plant-based isn't a step down, and they can have a great night out on the town and enjoy, you know, delicious food in a great environment.
So I like that you say that when treated with the same respect as any other cuisine, plant-based dining satisfies anyone who simply enjoys good food. Can you elaborate on what you mean by this and how this way of thinking can perhaps shift the paradigm that regular people may use when they think about vegan food?
Yeah, if food is prepared well, it doesn't matter, you know, what it is. People eat for pleasure, that's for sure. And the last thing they want to do when they cross into, you know, maybe trying a new diet, like a vegan diet, is losing that pleasure. And, you know, in the cookbook especially, we show people that, you know, they're vegetables that they're familiar with, but maybe they don't know how to cook them. So different styles of treating vegetables. Everything's, you know, very well thought out and planned out. And I think most people in the States anyhow grew up eating very bland vegetables, maybe boiled or steamed, and, you know, just with butter. And we do a lot of roasting and add a lot of flavors throughout the cooking process.
So let's move on to talking a bit about your new cookbook, which is called Crossroads. I had the gastronomic pleasure myself of creating many of the recipes from this book. I've made 11 so far. And
That's great.
Yeah, actually, it was my birthday a couple of weeks ago. So this is the book that I made my birthday dinner from. I made...
Happy birthday.
Oh, thanks. I made so many courses from this, and the people that I fed it to just really loved the food, as did I. So, yeah, it's not your average vegan cookbook. The recipes in the book are based on recipes that you use in your restaurant. So how would you describe the style of the food that you make?
Again, focusing on flavors from the Mediterranean, a lot of great fresh salads, fresh homemade pastas, and then a lot of just really great vegetable dishes. We, you know, every day we bring in different vegetables that are in season, and those are our features for the night. We get together in the morning, look at what we have, and just kind of go at it. And those features that we make nightly ended up being really the focus of the book, the small plates chapter. And if you've had an inkling to cook with, you know, cauliflower or parsnips or mushrooms or anything like that, it's all in there and all really unique and interesting ways of preparing them.
Yeah, I'd have to say definitely unique and interesting ways. It's because of this book that I discovered what black garlic is. So thank you for that. I made a couple of recipes with that. It just opened like a whole new world for me. And I can safely say that I know now what gourmet cooking is. So we need to address that, because like I said, this is not just a regular cookbook. It's not just regular food. It really it steps up. So from this book, I now know the difference of what a standard vegan lasagna is versus your grilled garden vegetable lasagna with puttanesca sauce. It took me 3.5 hours to make, and it's the best lasagna I have ever had. Oh, and I actually, I posted, there was a link online to a recipe of it. I posted on my Facebook and just like sang its praises, and so many people liked that on my page. So people love a good lasagna.
Yeah, you know, most people, we'll take the time to cook good food. It might, you know, not be every night or when they're home from work, but most people enjoy a good meal, and a good meal, you know, takes a little bit of time. That recipe is definitely an extreme time-wise, but there's some shorter recipes and easier recipes in the book. You just have to look at the ingredients and also plan by, you know, maybe doing a little bit of prep in the morning and, you know, making it easier for when you're actually going to be cooking the meal.
Yeah, I actually, because I made so many dishes for my birthday, I cooked for 3 days, which I loved doing. It was a birthday gift to myself. Another awesome, amazing dish in this book, it's the one that's featured on the cover, is the acorn squash ravioli with kale and black garlic butter sauce. So my question to you is, like, that's not just your average standard vegan recipe. What is it that sets your food and recipes and your style of cooking apart from other cookbooks, vegan or not, do you think?
I think mostly, you know, technique. We're very into cooking the way any professional chef or any kitchen would. Scott's background in Italian cooking, you know, it really shows. His marinara sauce, which is in the book, is, you know, as good as it gets. That would be my last meal. So, yeah, you know, just we're always taking things from a classical perspective. We're always recreating foods that you would never think are possible in a plant-based diet.
Yeah, speaking of recreating foods, for example, you use lobster mushrooms for creating lobster, and there's a recipe in the book which I was going to make. I didn't have time to. It's for calamari, but you're using hearts of palms. Can you talk to us about using different flavor profiles like that to create flavors that people might recognize in other foods that they might be familiar with that are animal-based?
Yeah, I think you have to really... You can't believe your own bullshit. I don't know if you need to edit that out. So if it has to, if it's going to taste like something, if you're going to call it something, it should taste like something. Like a cauliflower steak doesn't taste like steak. Lobster mushrooms, oyster mushrooms, they're named oyster mushrooms, lobster mushrooms for a reason. And that's because the texture is very similar, or the smell or the color is very similar. So we're very careful when we use those sorts of ingredients and how we use them. You know, calamari with the fresh hearts of palm, when we get these beautiful hearts of palm from Costa Rica, we braise them, we get them tender like calamari. We batter them like you would calamari. We serve them with the classic dips that you would get with a calamari. So it really helps with the experience. But yeah, we're not into just saying something tastes like something if it doesn't. It has to really hold true with the texture and the flavor.
Well, actually, this reminds me that one of our listeners asked me to ask you about the seafood tower, and I remember seeing a photo of that online somewhere. So can you explain to us what your seafood tower is?
Yeah, you know, it's a big thing now in restaurants, shellfish towers and seafood towers, and... again, always wanting to create things that people don't think you can have in a plant-based diet. One night I thought of, you know, how could we create one of these? And in the morning I called Scott, who really runs the show at Crossroads, and said, hey, can you get A, B, C, and D? We're going to create a seafood tower. And we got to the restaurant, just went at it. And two days later we had it on the menu. And you know, there's cold preparations like a crab Louis salad, oyster shooters made with braised shiitake mushrooms. On top, we had our hearts of palm calamari, two different style of oysters and casino style clams, where we would take the oyster and put it in an artichoke leaf and stuff it like you would a Rockefeller with spinach and breadcrumbs, and then bake it. There was just all sorts of different preparations that you would see at a seafood restaurant. And then we presented it on a two-tier tower, and people really enjoyed it.
Wow, it sounds super, super impressive. So I'd like to talk a little bit about cashew cream as well. I know in your first book, The Conscious Cook, you were widely, at that point, making use of cashew cream. All these years later, it's still a staple in your recipe repertoire. So for our listeners who don't even know, what is cashew cream and why do you use it?
It's a cream that we make out of raw cashews, and it stands in for heavy cream in recipes, milk. I'm not a big fan of using soy milk. It kind of tastes beany. It also doesn't have any fat, so you can't really cook with it. It's not going to reduce. It'll just evaporate. So by making this cream, taste is more neutral. And you have some beneficial fat that helps with the texture of cooking soups or really using it in place of heavy cream.
Okay, and what is your view on using meat substitutes, like the different faux meat products that are out there? I know in your book you say there's only one recipe in the whole book that calls for a certain meat substitute or a green meat. What's your take on that?
I think it's, you know, a great transitional food for new vegans, new vegetarians. It helps them create meals that are familiar to them. I think as people evolve into a plant-based diet, they look for new ways to get protein and to explore with new grains and vegetables. And so in this book, we really concentrated on that. It wasn't taking away from the purpose of what meat alternatives serve. It was just a different focus for this book.
So you are also the co-creator of a vegan line of cheese called Kite Hill, which is sold in Whole Foods markets in the United States. Here in Canada, we hear about Kite Hill, but we can't get it. So I wanted to try it for so long. So last weekend, I was in Hawaii, actually, and I made a special trip to the Whole Foods there to purchase a wheel of your cheese. It was the soft, fresh truffle, dill, and chive cheese. And I actually devoured it all in one sitting. So thank you for that. It was that good. And I'm no stranger to vegan cheeses. I make my own quite frequently. I've tried a lot of the commercially available vegan cheeses out there, but yours it's just amazing. And I would love to take this time if you could tell us about your cheese making process and what sets your cheeses apart from other vegan cheeses out there.
Well, I think traditionally the vegan cheeses that have been out for years have been either soy based or oil based, oil with starch, whether it was, alternatives that simulated the texture of cheese and simulated the flavor. They didn't really, to me, achieve that. So about 4 years ago, I met a cheesemaker in Boston, Monte Cassino, and asked him if he wanted to work on trying to create a vegan cheese that was made like cheese was made. And he said he was up for the task. At the same time, Dr. Pat Brown, who was working at Stanford University, him and I were introduced, and he was also working on a project that was very similar. So we said, why don't we do this together? We started Kite Hill, and we truly make cheese like cheeses make. We make our own milk from almonds, and we inoculate that milk with cultures and enzymes, and we're able to form a curd, which is then cut and pressed into molds like cheeses. And that's really the difference. The nut cheeses that have been out on the market, or some that I've even had in past cookbooks, they're just made from ground nuts. We actually make milk and form a curd from that milk, and that's really what true cheese making is. And then after that, it's aged. There's different aging rooms for the different types of cheeses that we make. And that's why Whole Foods sells it at their cheese counter. It's the first time they've ever had a cheese alternative in that section of the store.
Yeah, and I love that. I mean, I think that is, I mean, it's sort of a game changer just for how the way that the mainstream public views foods like cheese. Like, we're reclaiming that word and telling people that it doesn't need to be dairy to be cheese. So what do you think or hope that your cheese can do for the average omnivorous person out there who doesn't want to give up their dairy cheese because people are addicted to dairy cheese?
Yeah, I think they can, proudly serve it on a cheese plate. We have a ricotta style cheese that they could cook with, yogurts that just hit the shelves, just giving people more alternatives that, are maybe not even an alternative, but just a new way of eating. And that's what we're hoping to do.
Well, you've been vegan for much of your life now. Can you please share with us your vegan story and tell us about what led you to stopping the consumption of animal products, and also how have the animal rights and environmental concerns impacted you?
Yeah, it's always evolving and changing. And, I was a vegetarian for a long time and vegan now. There's just so many benefits today. There's so many reasons for people to eat a plant-based diet. And I love that there are so many different approaches that get people to eating this way, whether it's environmental or their concerns for the way animals are raised for food, or health. It just really makes sense in so many ways. So for me, there is no other way to cook. It's what I love. It's what I do for a living. I couldn't imagine doing anything else.
That brings me to another question is it's this obviously seems to be your life's passion. What motivates you to do this work? Is it, I'm just throwing this out here, is it just knowing that you're doing something good for the world? I mean, there's so many problems in the world that could be solved with people transitioning to a vegan diet. So like, how does that fit into what the work that you do?
Yeah, I'm driven by a lot of things, but from a culinary perspective, people always said to me, oh, you can't do this in vegan cooking, or it's not possible. So it's kind of fun to prove people wrong. It's also gratifying to create food that hasn't been created before. As a chef, you always strive to learn and create and do better. And for me, cooking this way, it's just, I couldn't imagine doing it any other way. So I think contributing new styles of cooking, inspiring other young people to cook, other chefs, I'm just floored at how many people have vegan cookbooks today and blogs, and it's so impressive. You know, it's like a 180.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that you couldn't imagine cooking any other way. I feel the same way myself, especially with vegan bacon, because there is no reason to use animal products in baking, which people seem to think the opposite about. But I guess if you don't know any different either way, like to me, it's just the most natural thing, right? So I'm wondering, yep, like what are your views on just standard methods of food preparation, that is using, which involve the animal agriculture system, versus making plant-based food in the way that you approach it? I mean, to me, it's a no-brainer. It makes so much more sense to use plant resources instead of the animal agriculture system, which is just so hard on animals and the environment. Like, why would people do that? It's, again, we need to shift, I think, the way that people think. But what are your views on that, like animal agriculture cooking versus plant-based?
Yeah, I mean, it's a matter of time. I think people need to be exposed to it in a positive way and not get hit over the head by it and constantly told that what they're doing is wrong. There's better ways to bring people along, especially people in the food world or other chefs, and that's by showing them that there are other ways to cook and other ways to prepare food. And it's, you know, a matter of time. These other ways of cooking are going to become more difficult, more expensive, and they're going to take a toll on people's health and on the environment. And like I said earlier, people will come around for different reasons.
Yeah, so, you know, I feel that you're playing such an important role in the vegan food activism movement. What are your hopes for this movement in the next 5 or 10 years to come, or what can you predict, just because you've got just such a great insight on what's happening?
I see it happening before my eyes, which is great. It's great to see change and to feel it and to have people appreciate it. And I feel like it's happening now. It's even in the past 10 years, I've seen such a difference in people's attitudes, other chefs, other restaurateurs. Yeah, I think things are going in the right direction.
And finally, do you have any future vegan endeavors on the horizon that you would like to share with us?
You know, right now we're just focusing on the restaurant and, you know, taking a breather from finishing the book, and hope people really enjoy the recipes from the restaurant that they can now cook at home. And that's pretty much it.
Well, that's totally fine, because you've done so much, and I think it's been wonderful to have you on the show, just to get an update on all the things that you've been doing since we last had you on. So thank you, Tal, for coming.
I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for coming on the show today to speak about your work in making strides in the vegan food movement. I encourage our listeners to check out Tal's new book, Crossroads. Check out his restaurant of the same name if you're ever in Los Angeles. You can also visit crossroadskitchen.com, and you can also find this link on our website, animalvoices.org. Thanks so much, Tal, and good luck in
Thanks
all
so
your
much.
Future endeavors.
You
Thanks.
Too.
Great.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Animal Voices on Co-op Radio 100.5 FM CFRO. We are broadcasting live in East Vancouver, And this is the unceded territories of the Coast Salish nations. Please join us for next week's show. We have a good one for you, as we do every Friday. Thanks so much again for joining us today. So we're going to direct you to keep in touch with us. Everything you need is at animalvoices.org. There you can tune into our social media and stay up to date with what we're working on. And yeah, we'd love to hear from you. You could drop us a line through that website or just radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. Let's see, if you appreciate the work we do here at Animal Voices, we always need and appreciate donations from members like you. That's how we stay on the air. So you can go to cooperadio.org and donate there. We would like to put a little bit of a call out. We need some help on Animal Voices. I'm leaving soon in December, and a couple other people have moved on. So we're in a bit of a transitional phase. So we need you. And that's how we found really great past hosts, is just by mentioning it on the air. So maybe you're listening, and if you want to get involved, either on the show itself or behind the scenes, do get in touch. We're closing the show with the song We Animals by none other than Lila Rose, a Canadian but California-based musician, vegan, animal activist. Remember to be kind to animals. And stay tuned now for Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith. Thanks so much for listening.